Blog Talk Radio.
Sound like a familiar tune, folks? Indeed it is. That is the theme from Ghostbusters, one of our favorite songs. And on this, the anniversary of the release of Ghostbusters, the original release of Ghostbusters, we have someone I get to call my friend. We have one of the Ghostbusters, Ernie Hudson. Yay! Good morning, Ernie.
Hey, good morning, Carla. How are you?
I'm very, very happy and good and well and excited that you're here.
Well, great. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and folks and Ernie as well, you know, you've been on the show before. And the last time you were here, you were on Broadway. I think it was Joe Wilson's Come and Gone.
Joe Turner's Come and Gone.
I'm sorry, yeah, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, August Wilson's play.
Right.
And that was 3 years ago. My goodness, I can't believe that.
Wow, yeah, time goes by, doesn't it? Yeah.
3 whole years. Yes, it does. And then, can you believe it's been, I hate to say this number, but can you believe it's been 28 years, Ernie, since the release of Ghostbusters? Which incidentally,
yeah, right.
Or coincidentally, was today, June 8th, 1984, Ghostbusters made its way into the world.
Yeah, that was a really cool day, and it's great to mark it and remember almost 30 years, and it's pretty amazing.
I know. But it was just like yesterday.
It feels like that, you know, it does. It feels like, you know, some things feel they haven't changed at all, and other things have changed enormously. So time does its own little thing, but, I certainly have fond memories of, that Ghostbuster opening experience and opening night and the fans and the music exploding and the movie being, you know, the movie to see. And it was a wonderful time.
Yes. Well, you know, I didn't realize this. I mean, obviously, Ghostbusters and all the characters have been, you know, kept alive over the years because it's basically become this a cult film, a cult comedy classic. But what I did not realize was that it actually was the number one comedy, number one grossing comedy.
Right.
Well, now I've forgotten the actual statistic. Was it the 80s or that year? Or it's just
no, I think
an incredible
of
number.
Yeah, all times until, I don't know what, I'm sure something now.
Yeah.
In the last 10 years has come along to knock it out of first place. But, yeah, it was the number one comedy for quite a while. And
You know,
certainly for that year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was pretty phenomenal.
Well, as it has happened, as I said, you know, it is you've been Winston Zeddemore now since then. I mean, you know, there's the conventions, the Comic-Con type conventions, and the science fiction conventions, and the autograph signings, and just all kinds of events that are Ghostbusters. And so, you know, I know you've been asked this a million times, but when you were reading the script, and, you know, it's 28 years ago, and you're saying to yourself, hey, this looks like a fun thing to do, or, you know, what was your perspective on the script initially? And then I was curious to know, just at what point did you realize that, oh, my goodness, look at the effect that this has on people, and when did you start to imagine it was going to become what it has become?
Well, I think it was sort of an evolving thing. First, when I heard about the movie, I ran into Ivan Reitman, who produced and directed. in an elevator at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles, and he was the first person who mentioned. He said he was doing Ghostbusters, but there was nothing in it for me. And so I kind of forgot about it. And then I heard that the script was, that there was a black character, that apparently they had planned at that point to go with someone else, and and they were seeing people. But I couldn't get an audition. And finally, I was able to get an audition, and finally I got the script. I think I got the script before the audition. I don't, you know, sometimes they'll give you pages, or, you know, you get the, we call them sides. But whatever, I read it, and I thought it was really funny. And when I did read the script, I thought, this is career-changing, and this will change my life. And I got to do this. And so when I went into the audition, I killed them, you know, as they say. Mm-hmm. And I thought this was it, that the role was mine. But it ended up being, I had a series of about four auditions that I went on for whatever reason. And Harold Ramis was there, and Ivan, and a couple of the producers. And finally, but I knew the script was so hilarious and just unique. And that was the whole thing. It was just very different, you know, with the God coming and the sky opening and all this sort of the Marshmallow Man. It was so different that I thought this is it. And when I finally did nail the role, and we started rehearsal, and I wasn't that familiar with Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd. I mean, I knew who they were, kind of.
Right.
I wasn't a big fan of Saturday Night Live.
Uh-oh.
But when I met the guys and we started working, it was just hilarious, and I knew that we're on to something. This is going to be really special,
right?
How special? Who knows? You know, movies, you think they're all special, and then when we started shooting in New York, and the reaction of the fans to Bill Murray, to Dan Aykroyd and Harold, it just really it started to feel like we were really making something that could, you know, could last and sustain.
Could last, yeah.
It wasn't until probably the movie was finished and we had a screening of it it was before the premiere, but when I first saw the movie with an audience and seeing the audience reaction, I knew, no, this was, in my own reaction, first time seeing it. You know, it's one thing to make a movie. It's another thing when you sit there and you become an audience member and you separate yourself from, you know, the work. That I thought, wow, this is it's a ride. It's a thrill ride. And I knew. And then of course opening night, and it just exploded. And then I realized, no, we're on to something. We've done something that really can last, because Hollywood, and working in Hollywood, and having done as many movies as I have, so much of the stuff doesn't sustain. You know, you make a movie, it comes out, if it comes out these days, and it may be out for a week. Very few people see it, and people forget it rather quickly. So having one that is number one at the box office week after week after week, and the song is playing everywhere, it was pretty exciting.
Well, you know, interestingly, did you have the... Well, I guess it's fair to ask this. Did you have the same feeling? Okay. Did you have the same feeling with the sequel, Ghostbusters 2? I mean,
you know, for whatever reason, when the movie came out, it was so big in 1984, and it just kind of kept sustaining itself, you know, with fans coming up and the kind of attention that I was getting because of the movie. I was pretty certain that within a couple of years at least, that we would be doing a sequel. You know, there was talk of it, and it looked like, okay, we're going to, you know. But for whatever reason, and I heard only rumors because I don't really know any of the guys that well to get, you know, an honest feedback as to why things aren't happening, the sequel didn't happen. And so I kind of given up on it. And finally, 5 years later, we... you know, came up with a sequel, and we decided to do it, but there was some issues, and I'm not quite sure what those issues are. I'm an actor, so I'm not privy to what's, you know, what's interfering with things sort of flowing the way they did on the first movie. And I didn't feel as strong about the second movie, even though I had more fun
mm-hmm.
on the second movie, because now I was really a legitimate part of the team.
Right.
I knew the guys, and it was just more fun to be there and to be in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie opened, number one I think the first week, and then something else came up. But so the movie did okay, and it's still
mm-hmm.
very popular. I thought it was much more family friendly. I see a lot
yeah.
of people, they're fans of the second movie. The first movie I thought was a little more edgy and certainly much more original.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that probably within the next 3 or 4 or 5 years we would do another sequel.
Uh-huh.
But that still hasn't happened, and it's very
right.
doubtful that it may ever happen.
Well, okay. Well, that's interesting you're saying that, because, I mean, for at least 3, 4, 5 years, maybe not that long, but certainly a couple of years, there's been the rumor that there's going to be Ghostbusters 3. It's coming out, and this person has said okay, and that person has said okay, and we keep reading, you've said okay, and then you don't hear anything. And so I know you're saying, you don't know all the details of what the holdup may be, but can you reveal this? I mean, is it still in the works to be done, is the third?
Well, I think it's still in the works. I know the funny thing is I think all parties concerned would like for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's kind of unusual, because usually somebody's saying, I don't want to do it. Everybody's saying they want to do it, but
right.
what exactly it is, it seems to be the problem. I know the studio would love for it to happen, because the fans are so strong and they've really
right.
been wanting it to happen. So the studio would like to see it happen. It's guaranteed money on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Ivan Reitman. I talked to Ivan. I know he would like to see it happen. And I talked to Bill. I think I talked to all the guys: Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Harold, Sigourney. When I was doing the play on Broadway, she came to the play and we talked about it. So everybody mm-hmm. says they want it to happen, but getting everybody to agree on what it is, I would love to see it happen. And I don't think anybody's much concern about what I think about what it is.
Right.
But obviously I do care that, and I agree with Bill Murray on the one point that he says to me is it really should be original, and it really
mm-hmm.
should be special, and it should be worth the wait. We've been waiting for, close to 25 years from the sequel, and if we're going to do it, let's give the fans something that it's been worth the wait. And that's how I feel. I want it to be. I don't want it to just be another copy of, the Ghostbuster, the sequel.
Right.
I'd love to see it happen. And it's still a possibility. It's always a possibility that they can pull it all together. But the fact that it's taken this long is not encouraging.
Well, yeah. Well, one thing, as you said, you want it to be an original, so that means excellent writing again. And here's a little twist for you. Have you ever thought about, because I know you write,
right.
you ever thought about, have you ever pondered writing that sequel?
Well, I do write, but I don't think Ivan Reitman and the guys who are, involved is really interested in letting that franchise go to anybody else. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Harold Ramis and Danny Aykroyd. Danny was the creator, had the original idea. He and Harold wrote it, I think it would be very hard for anybody outside, unless they're sort of. Harold had talked about the guys who do The Office, bringing them in, but I think it would be very hard to go and say, I got this great idea. What do you think about it? I mean, maybe, but I don't want to go down that road. There are so many fan-based movies about Ghostbusters where the fans have made all these movies and written scripts, and they send me the scripts, and they, But I would be amazed. My own son wrote a song. He's a musician, and he wrote a Ghostbusters song. It was actually pretty good, and he was trying to get it to the people. I'm like, dude, they're not going to let you in on that franchise. I would be amazed if anybody outside of that, because if it ever gets done, I just think it's very guarded, and so I don't want to go down that road. And there are other things I'd much rather do. I mean, I love being a part of Ghostbusters, but it has its place, and you know, there are other things more interesting for me.
Yeah. We'll ask that in a moment, but let me just announce here that if you are just joining us, folks, yes, that is the voice of Ernie Hudson. And we have been speaking about Ghostbusters. I get to call him my friend. And I was realizing that today is June 8th, and it was June 8th, 1984, that Ernie, as Winston Zeddemore, introduced himself to us as a Ghostbuster. So, again, we're welcoming Ernie Hudson. And so, Ernie, you're saying you have some other interests. Let's hear them. What would you be doing on your perfect day?
Well, on my perfect day, oh man, that's we live in sort of the West Valley of Los Angeles, but on a perfect day, I'd probably be up in the mountains. I lived in the mountains for a number of years. I love it in the mountains. I don't have a home up there anymore, but I love to go up there, and I'd probably be away in a little. Not a cabin. I'm not kind of a cabin guy, but someplace really comfortable, and writing, and just smelling the air and kicking back.
Practicing some meditation and yoga.
Just practicing breathing and being alive. Being thankful for just life in general. It doesn't take a lot for me to get happy, and just I can walk outside on a beautiful day and just go, oh my God, I just got to sit down and take this in. You know what I mean? For me, it's just a blessing, and it's so much around us to appreciate. I don't have a hobby that I go, oh, I got to run out and play a game of golf. And I certainly, there are things that I do, and that's part of being an actor. You have to do them to. If there's a role, I played a professional golfer in a movie a few years back. So I've played these parts, and so you have to introduce yourself to various sports. But there's nothing that I've locked on and said, this is my sport. Okay. I mean, my family's the most important thing to me, and, having them around, or certainly my wife being with me, I mean, that's kind of, that's my... that's my perfect day, and feeling like I've, got some writing done, or whatever, and feeling productive, and dynamics change as you get older. That's the other thing. There's so many changes happening now in my life, career-wise, the industry is changing, the country is changing. We're in this time change phenomena. And I don't know if it's a result of my reaching a certain point in life, or it's a result of things actually really are shifting that much. But I realize that you almost have to, or I feel I have to surrender to it and embrace it, and realize that it probably won't be the way it's been in the past. But that's okay. It's time to evolve into something new and hopefully better.
You and I, we discuss this kind of this spirituality topic a lot, and I'm just curious, and I've probably asked you this too a lot in our conversations. When you say you have to embrace the changes and basically be comfortable with the changes that come about in life, how do you do that? Because here's what I mean. Because I hear a lot of times, okay, you need to be comfortable. You need to accept the changes that are happening. And there's that part of me that says, okay, if I accept it, does that mean I'm complacent? You know, so I guess what I'm saying is that I sort of interchange complacency with acceptance, and I'm wondering how do you not do that? You know, maybe you can give us a lesson on how not to do that or how to approach it differently.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I know that, but I think the making it synonymous with complacency and acceptance, that's kind of personal, I think. I don't think everybody feels, certainly not the way that I feel. I just think that we look around and what is what is. I mean, it's what is. I mean, so the next thing is, how do you feel about what is? And if you feel about what is not very good, then you're going to have a struggle. You're going to have to struggle really hard to change it or to make it something else. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, until you do change it, you're just not going to feel very good. And so my feeling is, whatever it is, let me find a way to be at peace with that and just say, okay, that's the way it is. I don't have to agree with it, but it is what it is. So what would I like to see different? And then while I'm feeling good about what it is, I can start to work to see if there's things that I can bring about, the changes that I would like to see that makes me more comfortable. But I can't fight what is, because that's the way it is. I mean, I can... Yeah. I can look back and say what I wish it was or what it used to be, but the bottom line is this is what it is. Now, the big question becomes, is it really what I think it is? And when you dig a little deeper and start to look at it, it's really, you find, most with me, I find it's my perception of what is, which is usually faulty or false, because I'm not, I don't know all of the elements that went in, that goes into making it this way. And so, and what is always. It sort of shifts. It appears differently. It looks rough. It looks frightening. It looks whatever. And so the thing for me to do and remember to do is to keep fear out of it as best I can. You know, I say, oh, my God, the economy's falling apart. Oh, I better hurt and do something. I'm afraid. So I have to go, no, don't panic. Let me look at what is, and let me look at what's good about what is. You know, things that this could be potentially bad, but then that's when I say I walk out in the morning and I say, oh, man, look at, I mean, what a beautiful day. I mean, to have this experience, it's such a blessing. And so you find those things that you love about what is, and the things that you're not, you go, well, you know what, it's not my choice, but, okay, what do I do? What can I do today that will make tomorrow a little bit better, that I feel better about, that I would like to see it happen? I mean, I can't judge it because... Some of the things that look kind of rough, you know, turn out to be some of the blessings, and some of the challenges are the best thing. We need challenges sometimes.
Yeah.
So we can't.
Then we would be complacent.
Oh, we would be complacent. I think if I think if everything was just. But I think it's a challenge to remind yourself of who you are and how blessed we are, and to give thanks for that, no matter what it appears.
Yeah.
Because it's only our perception, and it's not based on, you know, all of the elements and information. How much of what is do we really know? And it's very little. I mean, how much of all that's known do I know? Well, not even, you know, not very much. So there's so much that I don't know that I have to trust, you know, and for those who believe in God and who believe in, you know, a higher power, you know, that's why we have faith, is knowing that, you know, all those elements are working for our benefit, no matter what they appear to be. And and that's what keeps you on the side of joy. That's what keeps you remembering what a blessing life is. And it's so easy to fall into fear. And then life becomes a very desperate place.
Yeah, and you know, you're saying the word fear, and I saw this probably in an email many years ago, but it stuck with me. I'd never looked at it this way, but fear is basically living in the hypothetical world. I mean, even the smallest things, you know, like I'm afraid of, you know, bees. I've never been stung by a bee. I don't know if I would have a bad reaction if I was. But hypothetically, you know, I know I've determined that it must be painful, and so I'm projecting things. You know, I'm projecting that there would be pain. I'm projecting all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And so Yeah, so it's like if we can stay out of the hypothetical world, and as you said, you know, just deal with what is.
Yes.
We'll be okay.
I don't fly an airplane, but I would imagine flying an airplane would be very important to be able to read the sign, the gauges, to know what the gauges mean. So when it, you know, that arrow's pointing down or wherever, you know, is it really moving in the direction you want? Life is like that. You have to read the signs. I'm not afraid of bees, but you know, I'm standing next to a nest here. Maybe I might want to move. You know, there are certain signs that you have to pay attention to. And when you ignore those signs, which is, and we all have that internal guidance, I believe, and we will ignore those signs. Fear will tell us in that hypothetical world that you talk about. And I like the way you put that because I hadn't heard that. But I think when you ignore those signs, fear will have you ignore really important stuff. because fear tells you it knows what's best for you. And that's when you get in trouble. But I think if you read the signs, you know, it's a big assumption to assume the bees care enough about you to want to sting you. You know, it's like, anyway.
Their way, yeah.
It may not even be true. They may just fly by and could care less about you, which is, you know. But if you go over and mess with them, you might have a different experience.
Exactly. Well, like you said, but the sign is that bees are bees, and let the bees do their thing. You know, just leave them alone. Let them be.
Right.
And, you know, it's basically, if you're sharing the same space, the bees are probably thinking the same thing. Like, why are you in my space? You know,
space. Yeah, no, we all, I mean, I try to leave bees and a whole lot of, you know, I mean, there's so many life forms. It's just astounding to me. Yeah. I mean, I go out in my yard and I see all kinds of forms of life, birds and worms and snails and things I can't even imagine. I see things that I didn't even know existed. I'm like, wow, what is that? It's kind of weird. And so they're out there, and I guess they have as much right to this experience as we do. Now, when I see them in my house, that's a different thing. I'm sorry, but now you're in my space. Well, I think I should probably feel the same way when I'm out in the woods.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm sort of invading their space, and so I have to be respectful, you know, so.
Exactly. But that's a good thing, being respectful of the universe. And now I can kind of put it, we've got really about 2 minutes to go in the program. And again,
oh, really?
For those folks, it's fast, I know. We do have listeners on the line. They all know to press the number one if they have any comments or questions. But they're holding on and listening, so that's good.
Okay.
And folks, you are listening to the voice of Ernie Hudson. Again, I proudly get to say you're my friend. I'm boasting, but proudly get to say Ernie's my friend.
We've been friends for many years now. it's been a long time. You know, I know you're only 19, but we've been friends for a good long time.
Exactly.
And actually, we met, I think, during an interview about Ghostbusters, if I remember
correctly. I think it was. Or we'll go with that one.
Or something. It's been a while.
I was going to say it wasn't before that. It was just maybe around there. Let's just go with that one. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Since there are just now about 90 seconds, do you any projects?
We've
got about 90 seconds. Second.
Well, I'm working on a script. I'm working on a script that's a one-man show that I hope will evolve into other media and become maybe a miniseries for TV or possibly a movie. But it will be a play, and that's what I'm focusing on now, based on Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion. So that's sort of my focus right now. And I do Transformers Prime, the animated series, and Secret Life of the American Teenager for ABC Family. But I just stay busy and give a lot of thanks.
Oh, and we thank you, too. And we're glad you're staying busy and glad that you joined us. And, yeah, that pretty much wraps up this 30 minutes. So I want to thank the listeners as well for tuning in. And, Ernie, as always, you're a great pal. Love you much, and
love
we'll
you
be
too.
Talking.
Okay,
on
great.
That,
I look forward
you know
to
what
it.
You go? Okay.
All right.
Take care.
Okay, you too.
Folks,
bye-bye.
Take care, folks.